Move on to our next case, Stockberger v. United States. Mr. Williams.
Please the court. My name is Steve Williams, and I represent the widow and personal representative of the deceased in this case. This case comes to the court on a grant of summary judgment from the district court on the negligent claims of the plaintiff under the Federal Tort Claims Act. I'd like to just briefly summarize a couple of the facts that are...
Well, is there an autopsy performed on Stockberger?
No, Judge.
Was any supervisor aware of his condition on the day in question?
Well, there's a difference in the record on that. There is a physician who had the job of EMT surgical assistant named Alexander Gostolano, who in his deposition says that Mr. Stockberger did notify a supervisor and obtain a replacement for him at his time of employment, or on that date of his death. Mr. Stockberger was a nurse at the federal penitentiary in Terre Haute. He had insulin-dependent diabetes, and that condition was very well known to both his co-employees and supervisors at the facility. In addition, it's...
One of the problems I have that I have with your case is that he wanted to leave. He wanted to go home. So are you saying that... the defendant had a duty to restrain him?
Well, I can cite the court to... I mean, this happened many times in the past, not only with Mr. Stockberger.
Well, I guess your answer is yes. I guess what's troublesome about it is you're imposing a duty on an employer that any time an employee seems ill or something, the employer shouldn't allow the employee to leave. And it's very odd, because usually you think, well, if you're sick, you want to go home, you should be allowed to do so. And now you're arguing the opposite. Then when a person is ill and wants to go home, no, the employer should restrain him.
Well, Your Honor, I was going to cite the example of another employee, Steve Gerton, who was also an insulin diabetic. He was a guard and counselor, and... the record shows that on a previous occasion, he was in an insulin or in a low blood sugar situation, and his supervisor called a hospital. They sent an ambulance. They came and gave him an IV.
I know, but suppose he wanted to leave. Can they say, no, you can't leave. We're going to call an ambulance.
Yes, I think that... I mean, my position is that they should not have allowed...
But you understand that the implications for liability are very broad, because you're really saying that we have to be looking around at each other to make sure, you know, no one is displaying symptoms of some serious illness. I mean, what happens?
Well, Your Honor,
it's very common for people to say, I'm ill, I have to leave, I have to go home. And now, you know, you have to have a some examination on the spot to see whether the person is fit to leave.
I understand your concern, and where I think the distinction is because you've got a condition here, insulin-dependent diabetes, low blood sugar, where a person's cognitive functions are impaired to the extent that they can't drive a car.
But where does that end? For instance, if let's say the roads were, you know, snowy and icy and Would the employer be obliged to restrain its employees from driving home?
Well, in fact, there's an Indiana case where there's a couple of Indiana cases where duties were imposed where people they thought were ill-equipped to deal with adverse weather conditions. I think a hospital or mental facility and a jail where people were released in situations that they had didn't have the proper clothing or they didn't have the proper mental capacity to be released under those conditions, and the Indiana courts imposed a duty there. I think the distinction is where somebody...
All those cases, there's so much more extreme in this case.
Well, I don't agree with that, and I know that's what the district court's finding is, but that's what really troubles me the most about the district court's finding is that the district court's obligation...
There are millions of diabetics running around. We don't think of them as insane, even though we realize that, if you have a sugar deficiency, it can affect your mental functioning. That's true of thyroid disease. There are all sorts of diseases that can affect a person's mental functioning, but it's worrisome to think that anyone who, if you know that you someone in your workplace has one of these diseases, that you have a kind of duty of watching over this person, if necessary, restraining the person from leaving.
Is it your view
Let me ask you something, counsel. Just to carry this a little bit further, you are also arguing that they have an obligation to convey him home. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Then, is the employee who is delivering him home, and he has an accident, is he covered by his employer? And furthermore, is his insurance company involved if he does have an accident conveying him home?
No, I don't think he would be covered by... Are you asking, is he covered by the insurance of his employer, or is it...
Yes, and his own vehicle being involved.
Well...
Do you see what you're opening up? Now, there is case law out there. And if there is a common practice by the employer that the employee who drove him home in Wisconsin would be covered under workman's comp,
and
if he was injured in an accident,
and it is my contention that there is an abundance of evidence in this record that duty was assumed. And other employees had been taken home numerous times in the past, or they had just what happened to Mr. Girton. They called for an ambulance, and the ambulance came and got him stabilized. That doesn't involve any risk to third parties or risk of accident to third parties.
I'm only asking about conveying him home, but you're expanding it tremendously on the employer.
Well,
and that follows through. That expanded on the employer. He's got to carry more insurance. The product costs that much more food.
I guess to directly address your concern and Judge Posner's concern, I think that each of these cases has to be viewed on a case-by-case basis. Unfortunately, this one never got to be viewed on a case-by-case basis. I think that the duties are there under Indiana law.
As Coffey points out, one of the implications of your decision is that the scope of employment expands. So you can imagine you have to pay someone overtime because he had to drive the ill person home.
What I'm wondering is whether... I'm sorry.
No.
Could I answer?
Sure.
But that there's no evidence like that in this case. In fact, quite the contrary. The evidence is this was done on a regular basis. There was a transportation vehicle there that was used for prisoners. That was used to transport sick employees on occasion. There wasn't any evidence that this taxed the facility economically or in terms of placed a strain on the employment of anybody. as a result of accommodating the insulin dependent employees at this prison in a way they should have been accommodated.
Well, is it your argument that an employer always has a duty to aid a sick employee, or only in circumstances where the staff happens to be specially trained to recognize that there's a serious medical condition?
I think that there's Indiana law to the effect that an employer is under a duty to aid or assist an ill employee, even if he didn't cause that incident, if it's a situation where that employee's life could be in peril, and that was clearly the situation here. So, no, I'm not extending it beyond that. I just think under the circumstances of this case, where it was such a perilous situation, I mean, the last person to see him, I think the record shows, is again, Dr. Jostolano. And I asked him point blank if he should have been driving a car at that point, if he had recovered to the point where he should be driving a car. And he said no. That's why they were trying to get him to stay. It's also a characteristic of insulin diabetics that have low blood sugar that they don't recognize that they're in peril. They don't recognize that they're in this situation.
Is it your view that they should have physically, you know, handcuffed him to a chair, chained him?
Well,
I mean, they have all that stuff there, so it's not, you know, like working at the 7-Eleven.
And they had a procedure. They were all trained, including the medical staff. They had a procedure called Deuces. All they had to do was get on their radio or get on their on the phone and call Deuces, and immediately, there were several examples of this in the record, enough people would gather quickly. It was an emergency situation.
So your position actually will deter employers from hiring people with diabetes, because it's understood the case, most of the cases involve, they're either sort of they're custodial situations, a mental hospital or a regular hospital or a prison and so on, or they're situations in which there's a work-related accident. You're a railroad worker. You have an accident on the job, the railroad company has a duty to you. But employers have assumed that they didn't have any responsibility with regard to the pre-existing work-unrelated conditions that people bring to their job. And now you're saying employers have legal responsibilities toward any employees who have conditions that might endanger them.
In fact, Your Honor, the ADA specifically recognizes insulin-dependent diabetes as a condition which requires accommodation. So, and although that doesn't directly apply to federal employees, the Rehabilitation Act does, which incorporates the same standard.
But it's one thing to say that you have to make the workplace accessible to these people. It's another thing to say that you have to become their nanny. You have to watch them on the job, and if they look too ill to go home, you have to take care of them, send them to the hospital, keep them overnight, something of that sort.
Well, there's two aspects of that. First, this prison assumed that duty. Clearly assumed that duty.
Prisoners. Yeah.
Pardon me?
To prisoners.
To employees. I mean, the record is replete with instances where they monitored the blood sugar levels of the employees with diabetes, and that they worked to get those blood sugars levels back up, that they did all sorts of things to control that situation. But here they did nothing. They didn't ask. I mean, we're talking about whether he should have been restrained, but he wasn't asked for his keys. He wasn't.
They did do something. They had him eat, didn't he? And he wouldn't eat anymore?
They had him eat, and then there was a brief period when they thought he appeared to be better.
Right.
But
then he refused to take any more. They said that you need more. Isn't that true?
Yes, I think at some point he did refuse.
Well, then what other obligation does the employer have? As I said, are we going to put him in cuffs and force it down his throat?
I think under these circumstances, at minimum, they have an obligation to say, give me your keys. You cannot be driving this car, or let me call your wife to come and get you, or let me call your supervisor, as they had with Steve Girton, to call an ambulance to come in and get him. I mean, the point is, they're letting him get in a car knowing he doesn't have the ability to get in a car.
Wasn't he told that he shouldn't drive?
Pardon me?
Wasn't he told that he shouldn't drive?
Well, I don't know if he was. I can't answer that question directly.
Wasn't he told it, and didn't they say that he would not accept any of that?
That they were telling him to stay. They were telling him to stay repeatedly,
right.
And he wouldn't accept that.
Right.
Which is, my time's up, and I'm unfamiliar whether I have adequately.
So that's fine. We'll give you a minute to rebut after we hear from
thank
Mr.
you.
Hunter. Thank you, Mr. Williams. Mr. Hunter?
May it please the court, my name is Jeff Hunter. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney representing the U.S. In this matter. Actually, the facts in this case are that the supervisor, Mr. Stockberger, did not know that he was ill on the day when he decided to leave. Mr. Stockberger contacted a fellow coworker who did make arrangements for a replacement to be provided. That coworker that was contacted, Mr. Smith, was not a supervisor. And in fact, during the conversation, Mr. Smith had no reason to know anything other than the fact that Mr. Stockberger said he was sick and wanted to go home. No other information was provided by Mr. Stockberger to Mr. Smith at that time.
Now, at least one of the witnesses himself was diabetic and thus testified about the effects of hypoglycemia. The other employees admitted that they knew the effects, which seemed to me to be admissions. I'm in my admissions mode today. Doesn't that create a problem for you on the foreseeability issue? And doesn't it create an issue on whether he was helpless? Because, you know, we're on summary judgment here.
Your Honor, first, as to the foreseeability issue, I think the facts taken as a whole here, including the undisputed facts, are that it was not foreseeable that there would be the accident. As a matter of fact, the last person to talk with Mr. Stockberger was Officer Gerke, who was in the control room, who had an appropriate conversation with Officer Stockberger, including the fact he said, you know, first he was asked if he was okay, he said yes, and then he said no, you know, I'm sick, I want to go home, I'm going home. And he hung up his keys, which is a somewhat complicated two-step process. So given the fact that Mr. Stockberger earlier had said he was feeling better, 20 or 30 minutes after he'd eaten, he said he was feeling better and he was still going home, he had an appropriate conversation at that time, and given that the last contact with anybody at the Bureau of Prisons was this conversation where he was completely appropriate and rational, I think that there's not the factor of foreseeability.
Well, what exactly is the scope of duty under Indiana law? Suppose he passed out, he went into an insulin coma or something. Can they just let him lie there and dies? Or
that's a very good question, Your Honor.
That's sort of the old-fashioned no good Samaritan duty, but is that Indiana law today?
Fortunately, we don't have that situation
no, I realize
in this
not
case.
That case. Curious.
I'm not sure what Indiana law would be on that today. I know that they would do the three-factor balancing under the Webb test, which is the relationship between the parties, the reasonable foreseeability of harm, and the public policy considerations. And that's a very difficult question. you know, in some factual circumstances, I suppose that there could well be a duty under Indiana law in those cases, because the person is, in that case, already, he's passed out, he's comatose, and action might well need to be taken at that time. But that's not the case here.
Let me ask a question about the admissibility. I think it's similar to Judge Rovner's question, but since these people know about diabetes, these co-workers, why couldn't they testify about this without the formality of expert designation?
Well,
they're testifying from their personal knowledge.
Your Honor, what actually the plaintiff wants in this case is not personal knowledge of the witnesses. He's asking for at least two layers of assumptions to be made based upon that personal knowledge. First, you know, the people could certainly testify about what they saw and observed, how Mr. Stockberger was acting and what he was doing. From that, plaintiff wants there to be an inference raised that Mr. Stockberger was suffering from hypoglycemia. And the question is, none of these people are Mr. Stockberger's treating doctor. they never have been engaged in providing medical care for him. All they are co-workers. They don't know for sure that he does have hypoglycemia on that day, absent appropriate medical test. And then there's a further inference the plaintiff wants the courts to draw from that, is that not only was there hypoglycemia, but that it was so bad that there was an immediate threat to his health, to his ability to drive. And again, that information, that is not something that could be drawn directly from the perception of them witnessing what Mr. Stockberger was doing on that day.
You know, I may have missed this, but how far had he driven?
Quite frankly, I don't recall from the record. It was not, you know, I'm not sure what the amount of time was. And in addition, then, to show that there was proximate cause here, there would also have to be the inference drawn that not only was, you know, he was hypoglycemic, that the hypoglycemia was so bad he shouldn't have been allowed to drive, and also then the inference that the hypoglycemia actually caused the accident. So I think plaintiffs ultimately have a problem with even showing proximate cause here. The trial court did not get to that issue. We raised it in the summary judgment motion, but the trial court didn't get there because of the finding that there was no duty.
Counsel, should we... Didn't the district court rely on the JAEW case?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that case has since been abrogated by the Indiana court?
Well, actually, the court did discuss the JAEW case. However, the district court also went through the three-step analysis required by the Webb case.
Yeah.
So that three-step analysis was done by the district court and done properly.
Would it be fair to remand this back in view of the case that the court relied on it?
I don't believe that it's necessary.
And now rely on the Holt case?
Excuse me?
And now rely on the Holt case?
Well, really...
Holt versus Quality Motor?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't believe that the court, that a remand is necessary for that purpose, because the district court did do the three-step analysis under the Webb case, which is what Holt says needs to be done. All Holt says is there's not, in essence, a presumption.
But he also relied on the JAEW.
In part, but the analysis was sufficient that
right.
He did the Webb analysis in addition to the discussion concerning the JAEW case. And I don't think if this court examines the analysis that was done, it's sufficient under the Webb case for the decision of the district court to be affirmed.
How can Mr. Stockberger's supervisor say that he didn't know there was anything wrong with the man?
On that day.
Then why did he ask for permission to get a substitute for the rest of the day?
The person that Mr. Stockberger contacted actually was not his supervisor. He was a co-worker.
Well, whoever he contacted.
Yeah, he contacted
and
some...
What did he rely on to get him a substitute worker?
Yeah, he was told that... Mr. Stockberger was sick and wanted to go home. That's
sure.
What Mr.
So then he knew something was wrong.
Yeah, and that's all he knew. He had no way to know that there was anything else. And that circles
back. Why didn't he give him food?
Actually, other co-workers did give him food.
Because they knew what he was suffering.
They saw him eating, And Mr. Stockburger said he was better.
And they knew what he was suffering from.
They knew that he was a diabetic, yes. Actually, Your Honor, I think that circles around to some of the discussion with counsel for Mr. Stockburger regarding the public policy considerations here. And I think the public policy considerations here are so strong that even if there is some question about the relationship or the reasonable foreseeability, that since it is a weighing of those three factors, the public policy is so strong that this court should affirm the decision of the district court. As the questions to the plaintiff's counsel pointed out, what they're really seeking here is for Mr. Stockburger to have been forced to have medical care, even though he was coherent and could carry on appropriate conversations. They're asking that he be forced to be restrained or to be forced to be taken to a hospital. That's a really very startling assertion of what needed to be done here.
See, that's why we ask both sides questions to get their view and have them develop.
What was the status of discovery at the time these motions were filed? In other words, did the plaintiff have an opportunity to engage in expert discovery, present reports?
The plaintiff could have certainly disclosed experts or designated experts. The plaintiff did not do so. There had been extensive discovery.
Yeah.
I think there's more than 20 depositions taken in the case, many of which plaintiff's counsel relied upon. So there was extensive discovery and extensive time. Also, as to experts, what the opinions of the other fellow employees, again, is based specifically on scientific or specialized knowledge, and under Rule 701, lay witnesses can't testify regarding those matters. They would need to be disclosed as experts, and they were never disclosed as experts. So, again, we think the public policy considerations here, no matter what, are just so strong and striking that there's no limit to the liability. There's a few other matters I'd like to address. One of the grounds for the court's action was the discretionary function exception. The court granted a dismissal of two claims under that. Those were discussed in the brief, and we wanted to point out that there's no requirement that there were policies or procedures concerning providing medical care or treatment. And there certainly would be a weighing of policy factors as to whether or not there should be a policy or procedure about providing treatment or transportation, because any resources devoted to those, to fellow employees, are not available to care for the prisoners, which is the Bureau of Prisons' primary responsibility. So we think the district court's decision should be affirmed as to the dismissal of those first two matters.
Would the prison ever be permitted to take a prison van and transport an ill employee, or is the insurance limited to?
There was some evidence that that did happen at one time. It's not clear whether that was originated from a co-worker who was concerned or what, but one time that did happen. It was not policy, and it was not procedure, because there was no policy or procedure. And in fact, to the extent there was a written policy or procedure, it was that only first aid related to on-the-job injuries was to be provided. They also helped with prescription drugs sometimes. But that kind of help was outside of the policy and not consistent with any written policy. Plaintiff also raised the question about an assumption of duty. And again, here, we would submit that there certainly was never an assumption of a duty to force people to have medical treatment or compel them to be taken to a hospital or keep them from driving. To the extent there was any assumption of duty here, there was no time when there's no evidence that there was ever a time that kind of duty was assumed. And even if it had been assumed, Mr. Stockburger did not want to do anything but go home. And that's what he kept saying, is, "I'm sick, I want to go home." finally, as far as the Rehabilitation Act point, there's just no basis for tort liability under the Rehabilitation Act or the ADA. That deals with conditions of the work. That's not what is at issue here, so I think the district court properly dismissed that complaint. Your Honors, as some of the questions have indicated, the problem with this case is the public policy considerations are so strong on this case. The plaintiff is asking for virtually unlimited liability and asking for the imposition of a duty that would put employers in an impossible situation in choosing between liability for people who go home when they're sick and choosing between liability under also tort or criminal sanctions if they restrain people who are sick and want to go home. So in light of that, we think the decision of the court should be affirmed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hunter. Mr. Williams, how much time does he have?
You don't have any.
Oh, you don't have any. Okay, we'll give you a minute if you have anything like to say.
I just want to, again, speak to the court's concern, and I guess it's framed in terms of public policy. I'm not asking for any far-reaching decision here which imposes any new liabilities on employers. The liabilities that I'm asking for are recognized under...
No, you don't have any case that's like this. So this would be an extension of the liability of employers.
If he was in a life-threatening situation, then I think that the Indiana cases create a precedent for this. But let me just read one...
Well, his coworkers didn't think he was in a life-threatening position.
Mr. Josfalano certainly did, because I asked him,
well,
you were concerned about him leaving, you didn't think he could drive a car, did you?
And they wouldn't have let him leave if they had thought he was really going to kill himself.
They did let him leave when
they didn't think
when he knew...
They didn't think he was going to have an accident.
You were concerned about him leaving because you didn't think he could drive a car, did you? That's my concern. My concern was that he wasn't fully recovered. That's why we were trying to stop him until he fully recovered. The other point I'd mention is, in terms of public policy, there was already a provision in what was called the Health Services Manual. It was one of the few provisions that pertain to employees, but it says all employees shall be afforded first aid treatment for job-related injuries. That is not so much different than what happened here.
It's not a job-related injury.
No, I understand it. It is not a job...
It's not covered by that. That's dealing with something completely different.
But in terms of public policy...
Oh, come on, but that manual you've read doesn't have anything to do with this case.
Well, I think it does in terms of...
No, it doesn't, because it's about work-related injuries.
The final thing I guess I would say is that in terms of foreseeability here, and I put this in my brief and it's in the record, approximately 8 months before this particular incident had happened, Dr. Gregory Lawson, and this goes to whether the supervisory people also knew of the severity of this condition, had issued a memo, which he gave a copy to Mr. Stockberger, where he says, your behavior affected by your medical condition is hazardous to your health. It places you in danger both from personal safety as well as medical health standpoint. So even the supervisory people at this prison knew what a severe medical condition this person had and knew on the date in question that he was impaired. I think
okay.
I've probably used my time.
Thank you very much,
thank you.
Mr. Williams.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter.